This is Up Close, the research talk show from the University of Melbourne, Australia.
I'm Peter Mayers, thanks for joining us. It's become commonplace to refer to the 21st century as the urban century, based on the widely repeated fact that more than half the world's population now live in cities. 2008 is usually given as the year in which this landmark transition in human affairs took place. At some point in 2008, one more person moved from the countryside to a nearby city, or one more baby was born in a suburb somewhere, tipping the global population balance from rural to urban. This claim is based on statistics provided by the United Nations, yet on closer examination, the data appears pretty unreliable. And while the process of urbanisation proceeds apace, the theoretical construct of a neat divide between city and country is pretty arbitrary and, according to today's guest, obscures more than it reveals. Neil Brenner is Professor of Urban Theory and Director of the Urban Theory Lab at the Harvard Graduate School of Design. He's both a political scientist and a geographer, and his most recent book is Implosions, Explosions, Towards a Theory of Planetary Urbanisation. In it, he argues that we need to stop thinking about the city as a collection of buildings and people occupying a defined space and start focusing instead on urbanisation as a historical global process that extends to every corner of the planet. Professor Brenner joins me in the Up Close studio at the University of Melbourne, where he's delivering a guest lecture in the 2015 Dean's Lecture Series for Melbourne's Sustainable Society Institute. Neil Brenner, welcome to Up Close.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
As a journalist, I've often repeated the line that we're living in the urban century and that we can identify 2008 as the year in which more than half the world's population became city dwellers, but you suggest this claim is based on dubious data.
Yes. First of all, it's important to put the claim in context. Around the world, we're seeing major transformations associated with cities, and these transformations of cities related to the economy, society, and the environment are viewed as highly relevant to the future of the planet as a whole. So the discourse around the urban age and this supposed 50% population threshold is very important because it underscores the importance of urban life to the future of the planet as a whole. And that's something that I'm very sympathetic to. I think that that's something we need to deal with and we need to critically interrogate. But indeed, the question is that proposition about a 50% urban population threshold that we've now crossed a plausible proposition, a plausible way to understand the urban character of our planet? And indeed, a lot of my research has recently suggested that it's not, that it's quite misleading.
What is the problem here? Is there something wrong with the way we measure whether people are in cities or in the countryside?
Exactly. So there's a long history for about 70 years of attempts to measure the urban population of the world. But in order to do that, you need a unified criterion for measuring what a city is, for measuring what an urban population is relative to a non-urban population.
So you need a standard unit of measurement, as it were.
Correct. You need a standard unit of measurement. And the simple problem is that no one has come up with that.
So we don't have a simple system like any collection of more than 100,000 people equals a city or equals urban or something like that.
Correct. Some sociologists that have tried to measure the world's urban population have tried to use a unified criterion. But it's very difficult because each country's census bureau has different criteria for measuring the population of cities. So the 50% urban threshold, which has been declared by the UN on a world level, is actually based on national census data from every country in the world. And those censuses define the urban in completely different ways from country to country.
So they're all counting it differently?
They're all counting it differently. In some countries, it's a relatively high threshold, 500,000, 200,000. In some countries, it's a very low threshold. Furthermore, in some countries, other criteria are added as well. And let me just give one example. In India, in addition to a population threshold, there is an employment criterion, 75% male non-agricultural employment. So the idea is that cities will be places where there's a lot of industry, and non-cities will be places where there's a lot of agriculture. This is very counterintuitive if you look at a map of population density in the Ganges Plain of India, a very densely populated but predominantly agricultural area, which in the Indian census is classified as rural. If you look at the population density data, it doesn't make any sense. It looks like an incredibly urbanized area. If you classify it as urban instead of rural, the urban population of India escalates quite dramatically. So there are many examples like this from around the world.
And this then suggests another problem here, which is that when we say that half the world's populations live in cities now, we're not comparing like with like. We might be comparing a Mumbai slum to a rich suburb here in Melbourne, for example, where people live in mansions. And we're saying these are both cities.
Exactly. And this already takes us beyond some of the empirical problems with the urban age proposition towards questions of interpretation. The notion of a 50% global urban threshold is premised on the idea that there is a simple distinction between the urban and the rural that we can use to classify the entire world. And the examples that you just gave already underscore there are many different conditions of urbanization that need to be understood on their own terms. If we subsume Mumbai slums and suburbs of Melbourne and other cities around the world.
Provincial towns that have 50,000 people or whatever it might be in, you know, in New Zealand's countryside or something like that.
Or a mining town that has a very large population but's devoted entirely to a single industry. Many different conditions of social life, of economic life, spatial organization, population density, and culture as well. If we subsume all of these different conditions simply under the notion of the city, we have to ask the question, what have we really learned about the world?
And so overall, you're arguing here that this much celebrated transition in human affairs, this year point of 2008 when we suddenly became Homo urbanus, the majority of the world's population living in cities instead of in rural areas, it's actually not telling us very much and perhaps maybe even obscuring more important issues.
Yes, exactly. So something is clearly going on. I do believe that there is a process of urbanization that's transforming our planet. But the question is, can we capture that simply through the idea of a movement of population from the countryside to the city? That binary, countryside city, is very simplistic and very misleading for capturing the diversity of urbanization processes that are happening around the world, as well as, very importantly for my research, what's actually happening in the countryside. The notion that an urban transition is expressed simply through a move from the countryside to the city, all of that implies that the countryside is simply being emptied out and that it is becoming irrelevant to the future of the world.
Or that it's somehow left unchanged by this. Maybe it has a few less people, but otherwise it's left unchanged.
Exactly. And a lot of our research involves actually looking at transformations of the countryside, which even though populations in the so-called countryside might be relatively low, there are many fundamental economic functions and environmental transformations that are happening across the broader territories within which cities are embedded that are fundamentally relevant to urbanization processes. Instead of describing the countryside as the rural, we use a different term. It is becoming an operational landscape. It's a landscape that's being activated and instrumentalized in very important ways in order to support urban growth elsewhere. One example that is quite relevant to this is resource extraction. We live in a fossil fuel-based world, and our cities, for the moment, are fundamentally premised upon the production and circulation and consumption of fossil fuels. Where do the fossil fuels come from? They come from massive holes in the ground, generally located at a great distance from urban centers. For us and the work that we're doing, those zones of resource extraction are fully urbanized spaces. They're not urbanized spaces in the same way that, say, downtown Melbourne is, but they're absolutely connected to urbanization processes.
I'm going to come back to this idea of operational landscapes in a moment. I just want to remind our listeners that they're listening to Up Close. I'm Peter Mayers, and my guest is Neil Brenner, Professor of Urban Theory and Director of the Urban Theory Lab at the Harvard Graduate School of Design. Now, Neil Brenner, before we come to the idea of operational landscapes, this city-rural divide we've been talking about, and which you're critiquing, a great deal has been built on this, hasn't it? I mean, if we think of a lot of recent writing about cities, quite celebratory writing about cities. So someone like Edward Glaser, who wrote a best-selling book called Triumph of the City, Edward Glaser argues cities are good for us. If you look at cities, you'll see that people who live in cities are richer, they're happier, they're healthier than those who don't. And therefore, this process is good. Urbanization is good. Are you saying Ed Glaser's wrong?
Well, I think we have to differentiate that claim in a much more historically specific way. We have to look instead of at the city as a generalized condition in which people live and about which we can make broad generalizations like it's good for you or not, we need to look at specific forms of urbanization. Now, a lot of my work looks at the connection between capitalism and urbanization. And under capitalism, I would argue urbanization is decidedly a mixed bag. On the one hand, it generates incredible technical and civilizational capacities, capacities to transform nature, capacities to improve the human lot. But at the same time, under capitalism, urbanization generates massive inequalities, so better conditions of life for some, but extreme exploitation and marginalization for others. And just as importantly, as we increasingly know in the current period, capitalism externalizes the environmental costs of its own production process. In other words, it generates massive environmental destruction without really providing a way to manage those destructive consequences.
Which brings us back to the big holes in the ground you were talking about before that provide the fossil fuels that drive the city's economy.
Exactly. So instead of just focusing on the city as a bounded unit about which we can generalize in terms of its benefits for people and so forth, I'm very interested in understanding a much broader set of questions. What supports urban life? What supports the cities that we live in? And how does that change social life as well as environmental conditions? And within that framework, it's very difficult to make such a broad generalization about cities being good or bad for people. I would also add to that, there are many different types of cities in the world. So it's a very important question to ask whether particular forms of city building, particular forms of urbanization are more or less beneficial to society at large and to particular groups of people. If you believe in criteria like social justice, equality, and also democracy, in other words, the idea that cities should be built and transformed by the inhabitants of the city rather than imposed from above, either by developers, business owners, or state elites, then some very difficult questions emerge about the form of urbanization that we currently live under, in which one might argue people don't have that much control over the conditions that actually govern their everyday lives.
Indeed, even within a city, you'll see there are different forms of urbanization that are more or less beneficial according to where you live. So Melbourne, where we are today, is often described as the world's most livable city. And that may be true if you happen to live in the inner area, well served by public transport, close to the beach and so on, but may be less true if you live in a far-flung suburb where you're highly car dependent and so on.
Exactly. One of the paradoxes of capitalist urbanization is that it produces incredible capacities and potentially very beneficial conditions for certain sectors of the population. But those benefits are not generalized across society as a whole, and certainly not across the world as a whole. But they offer us a glimpse into some possibility of a better future for all, which is at the same time being suppressed through the dominant economic and social system that we live in.
So you're not anti-city in the sense. I mean, if we go back to an economist like Alfred Marshall, writing at the turn of the century, between the 19th and 20th century, who realized that cities created something quite fantastic, which was, it's known today as agglomeration economics, but the spin-offs of people being brought together in terms of knowledge transfer, innovation, learning, skill development, and so on. Really quite transformational things that cities can do for people.
So my standpoint of critique is definitely not anti-city, and it's definitely not anti-urban. It's about affirming the capacities that are produced by modern urbanization, but at the same time articulating a very strong critique of the destructive consequences, both socially and environmentally, of the form of urbanization that we now live under, in the hope that we can collectively produce a more socially just, a more environmentally sane form of urbanization for the future. We have to build on the capacities that we've produced, but at the same time, we have to be strongly critical of those destructive consequences and, in some ways, the relatively undemocratic form of urbanization that we collectively live under.
So is this then a critique of urbanization, or is it a critique of our political and democratic system?
It's the latter, although even if I say it's a critique of our current economic and political system, many questions emerge that are quite fundamental and that need to be collectively deliberated about regarding what a different form of urbanization would look like. And from my point of view, that's certainly not a question that can be decided by any philosopher or any urban theorist such as myself. It has to be produced on the ground in everyday life through struggles in cities around the world, in territories around the world, to produce a different world, a different built environment, and a different way of managing, as it were, the unbuilt environment of the earth. That has to be a collective process.
So it's a kind of democratization or a re-enlivening of democracy beyond the kind of periodic system for elected governments. Is that the kind of thing you're meaning?
Among the many forces that underpin urbanization, a very important dimension of urbanization involves people, the inhabitants of the world, collectively trying to appropriate the conditions of their own lives, to gain control over the conditions in which they live. So even though we currently live under a form of urbanization that's dominated by capitalist forces, by developers, by political elites in many ways, at the same time, the inhabitants of cities, of regions, and of territories are constantly trying to intervene, to gain control over the world in which they live through collective processes. And that's a very important shaping force underpinning urbanization. From my point of view, the task is to create institutions that more actively enable people to gain influence over not just the built environments that they live in, but the processes through which future cities, future built environments are produced. This is a very important distinction for me. On the one hand, there's a task of gaining more democratic access to the built environments that we now have, to the cities that we now have. But at the same time, there's a question of who has control over the capacity to build the cities of the future. Is that capacity controlled by private developers? Is it controlled by political elites? Who controls that? And a fundamental challenge, I believe, for the future of urban life on the planet is to democratize that capacity, to empower people, the inhabitants of cities and of the world, to collectively exercise some sort of influence over what that future built environment will be.
Is there a problem here, though, in that democracy as we know it operates within systems of nation states? And what you're talking about really is a kind of idea of global justice and global democracy. So, for example, if the people of Melbourne had more control over shaping their own urban environment, one of their responses might be to say, we want fewer people to come here. Australia, I'm sure you're aware, has been doing its best to stop asylum seekers coming into the country. There's a similar debate in the US around undocumented migrants coming from Mexico. So couldn't the result of this kind of people taking control of their own urban environment actually be less just in the terms that it would involve people protecting the privilege that they already have in the developed cities of the rich countries?
There are many, many political and ideological challenges associated with the vision that I've just articulated. On the one hand, we have national states that continue to be the most important political actors in the world. On the other hand, indeed, we see new political movements by cities around the world to create networks of collaboration and knowledge sharing and policy development among cities that more or less bypass nation states. A famous example of this would be the C40 network created by Michael Bloomberg and others to promote new forms of policy development around climate change, specifically associated with cities. These are very, very important developments. And there's a serious tension between exclusionary practices on the national scale and the examples that you give at the local scale on the one side, and more cosmopolitan and social justice-oriented visions. And it seems to me that's part of the struggle that we have to participate in.
Because again, even at the local level, I mean, the residents of a rich suburb in Melbourne will do their best to put a lid on planning controls that might enable, for example, public housing to be built down the street from them.
And there's no simple solution to that. But I believe that any viable form of social justice has to be not only local, not only regional, not only national, but global. Any reasonable form of environmental sustainability, the same thing. Environmental sustainability, whatever we might mean by that, at a local scale, is not going to be that sustainable. A sustainable city that consumes fossil fuels produced elsewhere that generate massive emissions through their transportation to the city is not a very sustainable city. So questions of urban sustainability are increasingly on the agenda, and indeed they should be. But for me, the question is not only about sustainable cities, but sustainable urbanization, which takes us right back out to the global scale.
Mm. Neil Brenner, you're here in Melbourne to give a guest lecture. But you've brought with you an exhibition which is called Operational Landscapes, and you've already used that term in our conversation. If people go to see this exhibition, and we'll put a link to some images on the Up Close website, but if they went to see this exhibition of Operational Landscapes, what are they going to see?
This exhibition is a very experimental exercise in mapping, or we might say counter-mapping, by myself and my colleagues in the Urban Theory Lab at the Graduate School of Design. It will be somewhat surprising for anyone who associates the city and the urban with skyscrapers and densely populated landscapes, because even though it's an exhibition which is absolutely about urbanization, the territories that are being investigated and represented are extremely remote places on the planet. For example, the Pacific Ocean, the Arctic, the Sahara Desert, Siberia, the Gobi Desert, the Himalayas, even the atmosphere are under investigation. These zones are normally not thought of as having any connection to urbanization, but we argue that they've become increasingly operationalized, they've become increasingly integrated within a worldwide urban fabric. And so we've tried to map the ways in which these supposedly remote places have become quite functional to worldwide urbanization processes in a whole range of ways.
Is this an extension of the idea of the hinterland? I mean, I guess we're all familiar with the idea that the city has a hinterland. So in Melbourne, the mountains around the city and the forests are very important for the water catchments. That's the hinterland of the city, supplying the water to the city. But what you're suggesting is we need to expand that idea of hinterland much further?
Absolutely. So it's very much connected to the question of the hinterland in the sense that these zones, these extreme territories or remote places, have become part of, as it were, a global hinterland, not simply supplying a single city or several cities in the region or close to the region with, for example, raw materials or fuels, but rather they supply the cities of the entire world or significant zones of the world with important resources. There is increasingly a global hinterland, zones around the world, for example, of resource extraction, of minerals extraction, which have become supply regions for the worldwide urbanization process, the worldwide process of city growth.
So that's why, in your view, urbanization extends to every corner of the planet, even indeed to the atmosphere.
Exactly. We call it extended urbanization. In other words, a kind of dialectic, a tight connection and contradictory connection between the formation of agglomerations, big population centers, big dense built environments on the one hand, and on the other hand, just as dynamically, the transformation of much broader landscapes and territories in order to support the resource needs of big urban centers.
So how does this critique and this idea of urbanization as a global process, how does it differ from any other critique of globalization, for example, which is a common bit of terminology, or what Marxists might have called imperialism, the capital reaching out to extract resources here and to get labor forces there and so on? Why is this a theory of urbanization rather than a theory of economics?
Great question. So on the one hand, there is absolutely an element of both social and ecological imperialism in this form of urbanization, insofar as surpluses are extracted from the periphery and transferred to and consumed within the big population centers.
Wealth is being transferred from what we might call the countryside or the hinterland into the cities, which are the wealthy places.
And it should be added that in many of these peripheries, in the so-called global hinterland or the countryside, there are also very significant forms of population displacement, insofar as territories, land, are enclosed and people's access to that land for their own social reproduction, for their own subsistence, is limited, which also contributes to the rural to urban migration that's so often emphasized in the urban age discourse.
So we can think of traditional tribal people in Laos displaced for a major dam to provide hydroelectricity, for example, people in the Philippines displaced by mining operations, all those sorts of examples.
Absolutely. And land grabbing in parts of Africa related to large-scale agricultural production, which displace local people from access to the land for their own farming needs in order to create large agro-business systems. So a lot of dispossession and a lot of population displacement occurs. But at the same time, I would insist that this is an urbanization process precisely because it's not simply an abstract flow of economic relations. It's deeply embedded within built infrastructures, buildings, roads, canals, pipelines, holes in the ground, and so forth. So this is what urbanization is all about. It's about what the French theorist Henri Lefebvre called the production of space. So in order to create this supposedly globalized economic system with such massive capacities to circulate raw materials and information and people around the globe, we have to create a relatively fixed infrastructure in order to support all of that flow. And for me, that's what urbanization is all about. It's about building a landscape that supports the production and circulation of capital.
So what you're saying then is that these global economic processes also have spatial consequences, as it were, that they shape the landscapes in which we live, they create structures, they mold the world. This is what global urbanization is all about.
Exactly. Globalization is not simply about flow and circulation and mobility. It's fundamentally about urbanization, about creating infrastructures that are relatively fixed on the landscape and organized across the territory that facilitate and support that flow. Building those infrastructures involves very large scale and very long-term investments. But under capitalism, because the economy is constantly being transformed, because new technologies are constantly being developed, sometimes these large-scale fixed infrastructures of urbanization have to be creatively destroyed. You have to reinvent them in order to create a new infrastructure for another wave of growth. And many of the crises that we've seen during the entire history of capitalism, from the late 19th century all the way up to the present, precisely involve struggles to reorganize built environments, not only at the city scale, but at much larger scales of logistics infrastructure, resource extraction infrastructure, and so forth, in order to create a new spatial framework for industrial and capitalist development.
This is Up Close. I'm Peter Mayers, and I'm discussing the global process of urbanization with urban theorist Professor Neil Brenner, director of the Urban Theory Lab at the Harvard Graduate School of Design. So if we take your critique, if we take your approach of seeing urbanization not through the lens of cities as places that are a collection of buildings and people, but urbanization as a process that therefore also reaches into the Arctic, reaches into the Amazon, reaches into the Gobi Desert, as you say, and makes these operational landscapes. Where does it take us? Where does that take us in terms of policy, in terms of action?
First of all, it leads to a very different perspective on the urban character of this planet than the standard invocation of 50% of the world's population living within cities. That may or may not be the case. As we've discussed, there are many different ways to evaluate where the world's population is living. But the urbanized character of the planet is expressed as much through the movement of people to big population centers as it is through the operationalization, the functionalization of significant zones of our planet in order to support urban life. So I do believe that we live in an urban world and in an urbanized planet. But in order to understand the way in which that's the case, we oftentimes have to look far beyond the city limits in order to see the ways in which landscapes, environments, territories are being transformed to support the current form of urbanization. So that opens up a much broader perspective on urban questions, on urban policy and urban planning than the mainstream perspectives that simply draw a line around the city, a circle around the city, and ask us to focus on the way that people live and consume within cities themselves. We need to look upstream from the city.
So we're going to be less focused, if you like, on, I suppose, questions of urban design, creating pedestrian precincts or public spaces that people can use, reducing the impact of traffic on residential amenity. These are the things we tend to think about when we think about cities. We think about creating a more socially inclusive city, a city that's safe for old people, a city that's safe for young people, a city that's accessible for people with a disability, a city that's green, a city that's environmentally sustainable. You're saying that's the wrong focus?
So don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that these questions about how we live and consume within the city don't matter. They matter a lot. And indeed, we need architects, urban designers, planners, policymakers to think very carefully about those questions of consumption. So it's not about dismissing those concerns, but about adding a much broader horizon for thinking about planning, design, and policy. We need to redesign the infrastructures that circulate raw materials and people and other resources to the cities. We need to redesign the systems of resource extraction that generate the fuel that power the places where we live. So these much broader questions about energy supply, food supply, logistics are as central issues for planners, designers, and architects as the ones that are more traditionally focused upon within the built environment of cities. Now, there are trends within the design disciplines to start to grapple with these issues. Many of my colleagues in landscape architecture are increasingly adopting a much larger scale lens and precisely thinking about the redesign of large scale infrastructures as central concerns of the discipline. And I see this as a very productive development, which we need to broaden and deepen and extend. It's a very important part of my own teaching in an architecture and design school at the GSD.
And so there might be some overlap in areas like, for example, the idea of urban food production, which we see in many cities around the world as a growing kind of movement, people growing food in various urban environments, that would then take the pressure off perhaps the hinterland to be the supply base for the urban center.
Exactly. So the idea of creating more localized systems of production and consumption is very productive and has a lot of potential. It may not be the solution, but it's certainly worth exploring a more localized hinterland rather than the delocalized hinterland that we see under globalization.
Energy production would be another example of that. So locally generated solar, wind power, those sorts of things.
Exactly. And this has a lot of potential also in terms of the environmental footprint of our activities. If you have a more localized hinterland, it may undermine or limit some of the carbon emissions or other kinds of environmental impacts of our activities. But it may not be the full solution. We live in a densely interdependent world, and I don't think that deglobalization is necessarily the solution either. So cutting back on interdependence, it may generate as many problems as it solves. I don't think there's a simple spatial solution to the problems that ail us, but we can't even pose those questions if we simply draw a circle around the city and define that as the terrain of action. We need a much broader lens for thinking about these questions, not only of consumption, but also of production and exchange and circulation.
And does it mean that we need to declare certain areas of the planet off limits and say, we have to stop the city reaching into the Antarctic, for example, or into certain other areas? We have to kind of somehow put a barrier around them, stop them becoming urbanized in the sense that you describe urbanization?
Well, in some ways, it may be too late for that proposition or for that agenda, because I would argue anyway that almost every part of the entire planet has been impacted by human beings and by capitalist industrialization. So it may no longer be possible or productive to think of any zone of the world, whether the upper atmosphere or remote places with very limited populations from parts of the Amazon to Patagonia and so forth, as untouched by human impact. The question for me is, what type of human impact? How do we want to manage and collectively organize the way in which we're already impacting every part of the world? That doesn't mean I would reject the idea of declaring certain zones off limits for development. I mean, those are very important political questions that have to be dealt with in particular contexts. But the framework of thinking of parts of the world as pristine and untouched may no longer be a particularly viable way of thinking about the conditions in which we live.
And so you're not saying we should stop urbanization, but you're saying we need to decide what kind of urbanization we want, or take control, if you like, democratize the process of urbanization.
Exactly. We've already urbanized the world. We've fully urbanized the world, from the atmosphere to the oceans to the underground to the deserts to the Himalayan mountains. It doesn't mean every point of the world is urbanized in the same way. For me, urbanization is deeply uneven. It's deeply variegated. It has many different expressions in the built environment, in social life, and in the natural environment. So it's a deeply uneven process, but we fully urbanize the world in this differential, uneven way. So the question, indeed, is not stopping urbanization and promoting something else. It's precisely about the form of urbanization. What are its social expressions and consequences? How is it politically managed? And what are its environmental impacts for our own world and for future generations, both of humans and non-humans on this planet?
Neil Brenner, you work at the Urban Theory Lab, and the emphasis is on theory. It does seem that you put a big focus on urban theory. Does that mean that empiricism is less important, that data doesn't matter?
So data is fundamental. Concrete research is fundamental. The point of setting up an urban theory lab was not to ignore concrete research, but to set up a research agenda in which the focus is on the development of new theoretical frameworks for understanding the world in which we live. We always presuppose theory in everything that we do. By that, I mean that we're always presupposing broader interpretations of who we are, what we're doing, where we're doing it, and why we are doing it. For me, theory is precisely about clarifying those underlying interpretations around which we organize life, whether in our own everyday lives or in the realm of professional practice. So the idea behind a theory lab and the idea behind a lot of the work that we're doing is to critically interrogate the theoretical or interpretive frameworks that are conventionally used in relation to urban questions. And the fundamental premise from which we start our work is that the dominant frameworks for understanding and indeed for influencing urban life really need to be reinvented in order to enable us more adequately to understand and to influence urban processes around the world.
So we operate on a whole set of assumptions, and we need to make those assumptions explicit rather than implicit, and we need to challenge them and perhaps offer some alternative approaches.
Exactly. So the notion of the urban-rural divide, the notion of the city as a particular type of settlement that is different from all other settlement types, those are assumptions in the field of urban theory and planning that we inherit from the 19th century. And there are reasons why those assumptions organized thought and action in relation to cities during that particular historical moment. The question for me is, are those assumptions viable? Are those assumptions fruitful and productive for informing thinking, research, and action in relation to an urbanizing planet? And our work suggests that they've really become quite obsolete. We're devoting, therefore, quite a lot of energy to reinventing the conceptual framework through which we think about and try to influence urban processes. So the critique of the urban age that we've been developing, this 50% population threshold, is precisely connected to the search for a new conceptual framework for understanding urban questions.
And it seems there's a big emphasis on mapping, on the way we actually visualize the world.
Exactly. This is very important to our method. In the standard narrative of the urban age, we see a fairly simple map of the world. It's pretty easy to create. You look at where all the large population centers are. You draw circles or lines around them. Sometimes you connect them by lines to show that cities are connected to each other, but the rest of the world is basically empty. And there are many different versions of that map. Sometimes they're produced using satellite data, which is increasingly sophisticated today, but which still generates these maps of cities as being connected to each other, relatively bounded within their territories, and the rest of the planet, most of the planet, completely empty.
Even those satellite images of the planet at night, which show where the clusters of lights are.
Exactly. So the nighttime lights map is a fascinating representation of our world, and there are many insights that we can derive from it. That map is actually used in order to produce data and other maps on many, many other issues. So it's a very important source of information about conditions on the ground. But at the same time, there are major blind spots within those maps. The map of the nighttime lights suggests that much of the world is basically empty. And our work is articulated as a strong counterpoint to that assumption. We try to show that precisely the spots on that map, such as the Amazon or the Pacific Ocean or Siberia or the Himalayas, that look completely empty, are actually quite full with many different types of activities related to intensified land use, new forms of connectivity, so infrastructures of transportation and communications, and major environmental transformations. So it's actually quite misleading and even dangerous to represent those spaces as empty, because that produces the illusion that cities are basically self-sufficient and surviving based on their own activities, when in fact they're tightly dependent upon vast global hinterlands that enable them to grow and to exist in the form in which they do.
Neil Brenner, thank you for joining us on Up Close.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
Neil Brenner is Professor of Urban Theory and Director of the Urban Theory Lab at the Harvard Graduate School of Design and the editor of Implosions, Explosions, Towards a Theory of Planetary Urbanization. You'll find details of that book and other useful links on the Up Close website, along with a full transcript of this podcast and of every other edition of the program. Up Close is a production of the University of Melbourne, Australia, created by Kelvin Parham and Eric Van Bemmel. This episode was recorded on the 18th of March, 2015, and produced by Eric Van Bemmel with audio engineering by Gavin Naber. I'm Peter Mayers. Thanks for listening. I hope you can join us again soon.
You've been listening to Up Close. For more information, visit upclose.unimel.edu.au. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook. Copyright 2015, The University of Melbourne.